Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we sit down for a discussion with Mohammed Eid, who was born and raised in Gaza and worked with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, teaching in the UN schools in Gaza for several years. He currently is studying at the University of North Carolina and Duke University in the specialized field of crisis management. He's joined by Lori Mosier, who works with UNRWA USA, a private nonprofit organization that raises money to support the work of UNRWA. Mohammed and Lori have been touring U.S. cities, talking about Gaza and the work of UNRWA. We caught up with them when they came to Boston on their tour. Good morning, Mohammed and Lori, and thank you for your willingness to discuss your work with This Week in Palestine. Mohammed, let me begin with you. Please tell us a bit about growing up in Gaza and what led you to your work with UNRWA?
So, I grew up in Gaza Strip, in the south of Gaza Strip, in a place called Rafah refugee camp. And what people don't know is that the whole Gaza Strip is categorized as 8 refugee camps by the United Nations. My refugee camp was in the south. It's called Rafah, as I mentioned. So, growing up, we have always relied on the UNRWA, on the United Nations. The UNRWA was around us. We could always see that the UNRWA exists. It's a main part of our lives, of daily lives. I could know that because I would join my father for the food package we would have once a month. We would go to the UNRWA center and receive this food package. When I was at the age to go to school, the only education facility in that refugee camp was the UNRWA schools. And I wouldn't imagine my father would afford sending me to anywhere else. We didn't have anything, but if I would say he would send me to an education facility outside the camp, he wouldn't be able to afford that. The only reason I had education was because UNRWA would provide it for free at the camps.
But what was the quality of that education that you received at the UNRWA school?
I would say it was a very good quality. I wouldn't complain. And it's amazing how it changed since the time I was a student and the time, speaking about these days, how students receive education at the UNRWA schools. UNRWA is implementing a continuous development and in-service training programs. Back then when I was that was in the 90s when I started attending the UNRWA schools. And the place itself was very simple. It was just a small room covered with corrugated metal. And there is no heating still. There is no heating, no air conditioning. Very simple place, very simple chairs. Teachers still using the blackboard and chalk and blackboard. But it was good. The teachers had that belonging to the context. The teachers were people from the refugee camps. We knew them. They knew us. They sometimes would call us sons and daughters. They wouldn't even call us students, or we sometimes call them uncles. That kind of relationship, caretaking relationship, made the school a place of, it's like a grandmother house rather mm-hmm. than, or an uncle house rather than a school or education facility. So it helped us not just develop mental and cognitive capabilities, but also behavioral and emotional capabilities that helped us grow up psychologically in a very good place. So also the I would remember the healthcare facility. It was also 2 minutes walk from my place, and that's where I had all the vaccines when I was young, and all my brothers and all my sisters, and that's where my mom would deliver all my siblings, it was a free healthcare. The UNRWA doesn't charge beneficiaries for anything, and also I wouldn't imagine what would happen if I did not have access to this free healthcare system. Sometimes because we are in the camps and people didn't have that awareness of the importance of vaccines, the timing of vaccines, we didn't have that communication, we didn't have radio stations, we didn't have TV. So the UNRWA would actually deliver the health services at the schools. So we would go to school and the health team would come to the schools and give the vaccines to students. We would receive them on the health day at the school. We wouldn't even know that. Our parents wouldn't know that. No one would expect that. And it just happens. The health team comes in, and they provide us with the primary health care, sometimes dentistry check. And we didn't have that complications of school has to reach out for the families first, take permission, sign consent or something like that. The families have already given the schools all the consent, all the permission to do whatever they see or they know, they see as helpful or necessary for the kids. This relationship of high trust has always been the main thing between the UNRWA and the hosting society.
So it sounds like it was a very kind of personal education, and school is a kind of a community place that kids love to go. School, you like to go to school?
I would absolutely say yes. I've always loved to go to school. Summer holiday was very boring. Not because I hated holiday, but because we didn't have much to do during the holiday. We would just go out the streets to play in the streets of the camp. So having a school, having a nice place with all the friends, with the nice teachers, with a playground, that was much more appealing for us. So I grew up, and in 2000 was the beginning of the Second Intifada, or the Second War. And my place, the Rafah refugee camp, in my house, I used to live 300 meters away from the buffer zone or the borders. Which is 900 feet. My house is now in the buffer zone. I can't even go there. It doesn't exist anymore. So growing up in that area, I remember I went through tens of nights of military operations in that region. And when I go to sleep, I wouldn't ignore that. You can't just go to sleep and ignore that, because once I put my head on the pillow, I couldn't avoid hearing the tanks. The tanks has a huge engine. The tank itself is over 60 tons, which is 120,000 pounds. It has a huge engine. When it starts running on the borders, you can hear it like more than 2,000, 3,000 feet away. So I go to sleep and I hear the roar of the engines. Then they attack the camps. There will be shooting, there will be bombing. The bulldozers would be destroying some houses, knocking down some houses, and that is has a very loud noise, loud sound. We would be scared. We would try to find a place to hide in. If we feel the attack is being very close to us, then we leave the house. The worst part is that we wake up in the morning and we go to school. And the community doesn't have that psychological awareness. No one would talk about it. No one would speak about it. And we go to school, and it's at school when we hear from each other that someone was killed. Mm. And that person we would know, actually. So when we go back home, it will be the funeral, the prayer. We go to attend the service, the prayer, and then we join them to the cemetery. And people get back, and we stay in the funeral house for 3 days. Although we had those rituals, I would say it wasn't enough as a psychological way of addressing such a trauma. Once it's done, what's since passed, everything goes back as it's normal, or as everyone assumes that things should go back normal, but no one talks about it. It was only at the UNRWA schools when teachers started taking that initiative and making those circles and those groups of people, of vulnerable students who come from the crisis zones, and they offered us psychological support. When I think about it, I can't thank them enough, especially that they weren't professionally trained people do that job. They weren't paid. They weren't asked to do that. It's just they knew someone was going through a shocking experience, and they offered this thing. And me growing up and getting exposed now to how psychological traumas are addressed professionally, I would say they did a very good job with the games, with sharing stories, circles, with all the exercises they have done. I couldn't thank those people enough. The reason I made it all the way to where I am today, it's because I received all of that support when I was a child. So I grew up, my father at some point was offered a job by the UNRWA. His salary in the 90s, his salary started with $400. And that was a decent salary for that context. That's when I graduated high school. And the UNRWA provides education from grade 1 to grade 9 only. And when I graduated high school, my father could only afford sending me to college because he had that job. If he didn't have that job, and he was supporting my family, family of, now we're six people, I have five siblings.
And you went to college, right, in Gaza?
After high school, yes, right, in Gaza. So in Gaza City, which is 1 hour away from
Gaza City,
Gaza,
okay.
Yeah, I have to travel every day 1 hour or a little bit more. And I went to the engineering college first, but then... I realized this because, excuse me, because the blockade in over Gaza Strip, there were over 4,000 engineers, graduate engineers, with no jobs, unemployed. So the education ministry advised students not to study engineering anymore. I dropped out and I joined the education college. I studied English language. And after I graduated, I applied for the UNRWA job program. And thousands of people, I remember... At that time, we had 18,000 applicants, and the UNRWA could only offer a place for 120 teachers. The situation was very intense back then. The blockade, the unemployment was very high. So I started working for the UNRWA first thing as a teacher. And it was amazing when I walked into the classrooms, me now being the teacher who once was the child who would sit there, and everyone would look after him. Everyone would offer him the support and help, and now it's me paying back to the community. So I took that mission seriously, and then part of my inspiration to develop the work, I joined the master program, the graduate program for curriculum design and education development, and that's when I got my first master degree. I also got a second master degree in applied linguistics with focus on language acquisition and language teaching. Unfortunately, by the time I started implementing different initiatives and doing, I joined the education development program at the agency. By the time I was implementing different programs and initiatives and working on improving the work and the strategies, the agency had a very high pressure of paying more attention to the emergency response. So they transferred some of the funds and some of the staff to the emergency response program. I was part of those, I was one of those staff who were transferred. So I started working in 2012 war. I worked for the first time in the emergency response program. And in 2014 military attack, I worked for 50 days for the emergency response program. It's mainly the plan or the strategy was mainly based on three principles. We prepare for emergencies, we respond to emergencies, and after that we adjust the consequences and fallout of the emergencies. So for speaking about 2014 war, we've prepared for this war, for this conflict, for this attack. We expected that we will have 5,000 refugees. So we And that was based on the number of schools we had, the number of schools we could use as shelters. So we said, we'll use schools as shelters, open them. We don't have hotels, we don't have shelters, we don't have the infrastructure. And schools are just classrooms, we can use them as a refugee shelter. So we expected 5,000 refugees, stored some food, some water, and whatever services we would need. when the crisis started, I remember we had the 5,000 refugees in the first 3-4 days.
Yeah.
By the end of the attack, the 50 days, I remember the UNRWA had 300,000 refugees on site, which is 6 times more than we could host or deal with. I took that job seriously because we have always been saying that you might be the only hope that someone would have, or the only help someone would rely on. Definitely, it's not a dream job. I have chosen myself. I did not consciously grow up dreaming that I want to be an emergency response staff. But now, worked in that program and worked in that context and realized how much I change people's lives, how much I contribute to people, to people's safety. I took this job professionally, and what I'm studying now is how to professionally deliver this service.
Well, that's what you're studying at, was it University of Carolina?
Yes.
In Duke?
Yeah. So I'm doing a double major program now. I'm studying global studies and international development with focus in humanitarian effectiveness. And part of my study is how can we deliver humanitarian aid more effectively? How can we address crises? How we can provide protections, better protection to beneficiaries and refugees.
So you plan on going back to Gaza?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If the UNRWA still exists in Gaza Strip, which is a matter of now, updates keep happening every day. If the UNRWA is still operating in Gaza Strip, I'll definitely go back to join the UNRWA staff. If the UNRWA suffers of a huge fund cut or operation cut in Gaza Strip, I would like to take the opportunity before getting back to Gaza Strip and work in different crisis zones around the world. Get more experience to enrich the operating or to enrich the mission in Gaza Strip once I'm back.
So you're really doing crisis management, and you're thinking of before going back to Gaza, going to other sort of emergency spots throughout the world.
Yes. So this is a very important thing. I came to realize that when I joined the university here. Sometimes I share stories, I share strategies and tactics we use in Gaza Strip, which is, as you said, it's called all crisis management, part of the crisis management. And people coming from different contexts, they would share something completely different, and they would say, well, that might not work in our context, or we might try something else and it worked even better. And it's amazing how people develop these strategies based on the circumstances they live through. And then I met some people who have professionally spent their lives in the emergency response and crisis management, and they had a plan of serving in different crisis zones around the world for the purpose of learning and exchanging experiences between different contexts. I met people who have served in every single crisis zone around the world before they retire. So I thought, this is a professional development plan. Yes, I want to serve humanity first thing in different places. Second thing, I want to do this in a professional and a good way. And part of doing this is to go around in different conflict zones, learn, teach, and share my experience.
How long will you be studying in North Carolina? How long before you get your degree?
So the program at North Carolina, the graduate program, is 2 years program. I've already finished 1 year. I'm in my third semester now, 1 semester left to go, the spring semester. So probably next May or so, July maybe, I'll graduate.
Let's bring Lori into this. Let's talk a bit about UNRWA and maybe how it's supported. You've talked about the role of UNRWA in Gaza, which is the lifeline. That sounds to me, it's the lifeline. And now we hear the United States is going to withdraw support, creating enormous problems for the lifeline. So let's talk about it. Lori, talk about what you're doing and a bit, tell us a bit about UNRWA.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, John, for having us. So UNRWA is mainly funded through state nation-state governments who pledge money every year to continue the operations of UNRWA. And historically, the U.S. has been the largest contributor towards UNRWA's annual operating budget since it began operations in 1950. And so this year, in January, the U.S. administration did give UNRWA $60 million, but it froze the remainder of the funding that it was that it had committed to giving this year. And the remainder of that funding is $300 million. And so that started a funding crisis for UNRWA, trying to figure out how to mobilize that funding to be able to continue providing its services through the end of the year. And it wasn't until the end of August that the U.S. administration did announce that they were not going to just freeze that funding, but cut it altogether. And so not just cut the funding for this year, but also future years, for as far as we know, for the rest of this administration. So at this point, UNRWA is trying to do everything that it can to replace the U.S. government funding contribution. Since it was a third of UNRWA's operating budget, it's a huge amount to replace. Typically, UNRWA also starts the beginning of the year at a deficit. So at the beginning of 2018, UNRWA works on a calendar year, there was a deficit of about $450 million, including the U.S. administration's cut. And now, as of a couple weeks ago, we've dropped that down to $64 million in deficit. So UNRWA's made huge strides in trying to close that funding gap. A large portion of that was due to the United Nations General Assembly. There was a ministerial meeting where they raised $122 million, where countries who have already committed to UNRWA stepped up their contributions, increasing them, as well as some new countries also contributing that haven't in the past. So UNRWA is committed to finding those resources to be able to continue funding. But because of the crisis and the cash flow troubles that UNRWA has been trying to manage throughout the year, it has meant a cut in services and a cut in staff in different places of UNRWA's operations.
Including schools?
Schools have not been cut. School education is one of the number one priorities for UNRWA to be able to maintain that service for beneficiaries. So it has been a question of whether or not UNRWA would be able to keep its schools open, but they have been able to open schools on time this year, and it looks like they'll be able to keep them open through the end of the year. Now, next year's budget is another question in terms of where is the money going to come from to replace the U.S. contribution. UNRWA is working very hard on that, with, again, nation-state governments trying to increase their contributions and also look elsewhere to be able to replace that funding.
And another problem, of course, is that because of the repeated destruction of Gaza by Israel, a number of the nations that had pledged money to rebuild, help rebuild Gaza, now are withholding that because it's like, they feel it's like throwing money down a rat hole when you build and then it gets destroyed again. And so I think Gaza has that problem also of long-term rehabilitation with this repeated destruction. It is.
I remember the Cairo conference or the Cairo event that took place in 2014, where countries pledged millions of dollars to rebuild Gaza Strip, and when it was time for the UNRWA to implement the program and to receive that fund, those countries have actually asked that Israel commit not to destroy those facilities and infrastructure that will be built. And of course, the response was negative. And the shocking fact is that that money would have gone to build bridges, to build the power station, to build the water station. It was civil infrastructure to serve only civilians. But then there was no commitment of not attacking them again. That's why some of the countries did not commit to their to the donations they have already promised to give, which at the same time reflect on the people's life. It just adds more misery to the situation, and people suffer more when they don't have those facilities and those services. Of course, the UNRWA has nothing to do with that. They can't do anything. Mm-hmm. The UNRWA We have always instructed to just keep our focus on the humanitarian efforts, and someone else would be taking care with the political side. So the UNRWA wouldn't discuss politics. They wouldn't even say, they wouldn't even negotiate the terms of donations between those countries and Israel, and making Israel commit to not target them again. Maybe senior officials from the UN might do this mission or this job, but the UNRWA itself is just a humanitarian and a neutral organization focusing only on the humanitarian efforts.
So, Mohammed, tell us about how you got out of Gaza, which is not easy. How did you get out of Gaza to come and study?
Getting out of Gaza, it might sound surprising, but it took me 100 days. And even when I say that to my friends, they say, oh, that's nothing, you're lucky. It took me 100 days. Throughout the summer, 3 months, I've been trying to get out of Gaza Strip. I have already received unconditional admission from universities. I have done the language test, everything. I needed to get out of Gaza Strip to do the visa interview at the U.S. office in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. They had one in Jerusalem back then. But then the Israeli army wouldn't allow me. They said, Arabs from Gaza Strip are not allowed into Jerusalem, neither Tel Aviv. So I started by sending a travel permit, that's what they call it, travel permit, to the Israeli coordination office. And me as individual, I can't do that. I'm not allowed to do it. I have to find an organization, international one, who would send it on my behalf. And they can't do that unless if I was a staff. So my organization, the UNRWA, accepted to send the application on my behalf because my travel was related to my work. My program would be related to my work. They sent the application, and the way they communicate with the Israeli coordination office, it's a one-way communication. They just send applications and wait to hear back. They never talk, they never discuss, they never follow up. They can't even follow up. If they follow up many times, they risk me being put on the blacklist of travel as a kind of punishment.
You're punished, yeah.
Yeah. But then we never heard back, and I was preparing to travel, so I got my fellowship organization involved in the process, and that was Rotary from the United States, so they would reach out from the United States to the Israeli Army Coordination Office and say, we have a student, we want to get him out of Gaza Strip, and he have already submitted an application. Just tell us, what is it about? Like, do you have something against him? Is it something we should know about him? Why are you rejecting his application?
Because you just didn't hear.
Yeah. And also they wouldn't get back to them. So eventually after 3 months, that's when it started, when they started getting back to them. And 7 times they said, they reached out to me at night, they said, pack your stuff through my organization. They said, pack your stuff and come tomorrow morning to the borders. I did that 7 times. I would go through the investigation, the search, and then by the end of the day they send me back to Gaza Strip.
What would they say? Why did they send you back? What was their reason?
So I would be, when that happened, I would be sitting in the waiting room or the waiting hall, and someone would walk in. The air is crossing, I would be traveling through. It's run by the army. I walk into the air is crossing, and there is tanks, there is soldiers with machine guns everywhere. It's run by the army. A soldier would come with a machine gun. He had my ID card. He would give it to me. He would point to the door that goes to Gaza, and he says, go through that door, walk back home. Sometimes I would ask him why, sometimes I wouldn't even dare looking at his face. But it doesn't matter.
Completely arbitrary.
He would never answer such a question, yeah. Just go back to Gaza Strip. So it was the 8th time when they allowed me to travel. It was very intense, very difficult. And I felt sad when I traveled. I felt sad because I knew people back in Gaza Strip who were really would, I'd say, more deserve this opportunity than I am. My friends I know, were admitted to Oxford and to Cambridge universities for the medical college. They would go and study medicine at Cambridge and Oxford. and get back to Gaza Strip and support the health community and the health services. They were some of the most intelligent people I've met in my life, and they never traveled. I left and they were behind, and I was just thinking about them all the time. They deserve the support. I wish if I can give them even mine. Many hundreds of students in Gaza Strip every year receive full sports and scholarships.
And can't get out.
They can't get out. It just goes away. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And I can't think why education. When I worked for the UNRWA, they had a slogan for the education department, which is "Peace starts here," because the UNRWA believed that peace really starts with the education. I don't know how does that help having a education blockade over Gaza Strip. Whom does that serve anyway? It's always better to work and negotiate and deal with people who are highly educated. The community needs education. The community needs development. It doesn't make any sense destroying the community on all aspects, on all levels, in such a way as it happens in Palestine.
Let me ask another question, another issue in Gaza, and that is the political issue. Gaza not only has a struggle with Israel, but has a struggle between Hamas and Fatah, the whole political dynamic. Where do you see that going?
So, unfortunately, and Palestine in general, it's not like the other Arab countries. It doesn't have this strong dictatorship. It never had them. Luckily, we don't have the strong dictatorships, and we don't have the strong radical extreme groups, as we saw in Iraq and Syria and other contexts. So, we had the experience with electing or voting for the Hamas party to rule in Gaza Strip. And immediately, as Hamas took the government, Israel enforced the blockade over Gaza Strip and sanctioned the Palestinian Authority because they allowed an Islamic movement or allowed Hamas to get into the government. So the whole situation got mixed up, and that helped actually keep Hamas in power more than 4 years. Because elections would take place every 4 years, but when we got separated, geographically separated, the government was sanctioned. Everything got mixed up. So since then we couldn't read the national elections. Me personally speaking, I would love to practice my right again to choose someone else to rule over Gaza Strip. And that's the democratic problem, the democratic process. That's the democracy. That's the game. You elect someone, you vote for someone, and then after 4 years, you vote for someone else. Hamas in Gaza Strip, although I disagree very much with the Hamas way of ruling Gaza Strip and running Gaza Strip, I'm happy and proud to say that I did not vote for Hamas in the first place because I was young, I couldn't vote. But my family, none of my family voted for them. Not my father, not my mother, none of us voted for them. Even if they voted, I wouldn't. They just practiced their political right. But the thing I'd like to mention is that people have been criticizing Hamas so much in Gaza Strip. People have been talking up against Hamas, and because Hamas couldn't go for national elections, the only thing they would do was that fine, we'll dismantle the government, give away everything, and whoever wants to take over is more than welcome to do that. And that's what happened. The government, we had something in Gaza Strip, not government, but it's called Administrative Committee, which was run by Hamas officials or politicians who were elected. Eventually was dismantled, and they gave in to Fatah. They said, Gaza Strip is all yours, the government is all yours, we can't take criticism anymore. What happened is that when Fatah was about to take over Gaza Strip, come back to Gaza Strip, immediately Israel, the Israeli government said that we will not transfer money to Palestinian Authority if you go to Gaza Strip and do the unity with Gaza Strip between the Gaza and West Bank. So Palestinian Authority survives on the international aid and the money that comes through the Israeli banks and the Israeli government. So they stopped the whole reconciliation process. And then Gaza Strip now is left with no one to run. Simply put, there's no one running Gaza Strip right now. Hamas has no interest to take all this responsibility, all this criticism. Hamas started out as a charity movement, helping people, giving them money, giving them aid. They don't want to risk all this reputation they had through the years. They have been trying their best to just provide simple aid, to provide some relief to the community. The community is still angry with the Hamas movement, but they're in a very bad situation. They have given away everything, and no one wants to take Gaza Strip, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask this broad question. It's one I guess we ask each other all the time about Gaza, and that is, given the current reality, where's the hope, or is there hope? What kind of vision do people have for a way out of this, or is there one? What's your take on where we go?
Well, the hope doesn't lie far away from where we're sitting right now. It's actually in this country. I put it this simply. The only solution would be the international pressure, the international role. The largest U.S. aid in the whole of the U.S. history goes to Israel in military mm-hmm. aid. In military aid, literally, that simple. The largest support Israel you have is from the United States. The U.S. administration used the veto in the United Nations for Israel, to protect Israel. If the U.S. administration decides that we will address this crisis neutrally, we would focus on the humanitarian side, which is the first step. This is what I've been studying, and this is what we have been discussing. The first step, if the U.S. says this is a humanitarian crisis, not a political one, first step, we want to open humanitarian access, humanitarian gate or bridge to the Palestinian crisis, address all the humanitarian needs. That's number one. Number two, we should stop all acts of violence, all the acts of warfare that are happening over there. And number three, we start focusing on development, investment, and integrating geographically. We can't separate Palestine and Israel. Integrating investments on both Israel and Palestinian corporation and businesses in Palestine. Once we start with these steps, number four would be politics, speaking politics. And then in that scenario, you can't... all the studies about conflict resolution, all the political research says to you, it's very easy to work on reconciliation, to work on politics, when you have people interdependent on each other. When you have people dependent on each other, you have businesses dependent on each other. People are unlikely to disagree with someone who helps them, who helps running their business or makes their business successful. So focusing on three things, which is the main four aspects of the international development: stability, humanitarian aid, development, and the fourth thing I would add, which is human rights. Addressing those four steps by a government or by a very powerful state like the U.S. administration would definitely solve the problem sooner than you would imagine. I wouldn't be very ambitious and give you, I'd say, a few days, but literally, it's so powerful there. Yeah,
I agree. I think, to a large extent, we're the problem, and we can be the solution in this country.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I think, to a large extent, we're the problem, and we can be the solution in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. It can be a major part of the solution. Mm.
Well, Mohammed, thank you very much. This has been incredible. And Laurie, you know, to get this kind of insight and to get this kind of narrative, this is what we do. Let people talk. Let Palestinians talk. Tell your story. So, and you're on a kind of a tour around the country now. You're going to be speaking again in Boston. So yes. We wish you much success on your tour.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and appreciate you giving me the platform to reach out to people and share my story. And I would thank the U.S. community, the American community. As you mentioned, I've been on a tour, kind of, and the community has been very hospitable. They have been very nice, very kind, very understanding, very willing to know and listen. So I ask, and very supportive. They have been giving donations to the UNRWA USA, helping keeping schools open, helping the aid program, helping sustain the aid programs. So I thank them, honestly, from the bottom of my heart. This is very amazing, very touching. And thank you very much for everything.
Thank you. You have been listening to Mohammed Eid from Gaza and Lori Mosier representing UNRWA USA. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. If that is too early for you on a Sunday morning, you can hear the program later in the day or at any other time of the week via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.